From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, sexual assault survivors condemn sports doctor Larry Nassar and MSU leaders.
They are partly responsible for this happening. You can't get to 100 victims without some adults looking the other way.
Plus, last night's meteor show.
This bolide type of meteor has a crescendo of brightness, and then it just gets bigger and bigger and bigger, and it's this giant ball, and then it goes in this huge flash. And then it's out.
Renowned artist Alexis Rockman on his new work exploring the past, present, and future of the Great Lakes.
The future of fresh water is really the future of mankind.
And the West Michigan dad who invented a new toy for his kids that ultimately became the snowboard. Those stories and much more for you today on Stateside. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. As we all know by now, the sky lit up last night around 8:10, a brilliant flash, and then a boom. And that left people in Michigan and across the upper Midwest wondering, what was that?
I was sitting at the kitchen table, and I saw a flash of light, and I thought, my neighbor lives next door. She's 90 years old, and I thought it came from her window. So I got several neighbors in the community in an uproar thinking that it was something in her house, only to later find out it was a comet.
Well, it was just a flash, like a flash of lightning, and then kind of a roaring, gentle roaring for a bit.
And then all of a sudden we saw this big green flash that kind of looked like lightning. So we were like, what the heck was that? And we were joking, we're like, was it an alien or what was it?
Initially I thought it was thunder, but it knew it couldn't be thunder because it wasn't the right kind of weather for it.
Thought for a second it was like the power box flashing or something, or maybe a lightning strike. Checked outside, didn't see anything, so we just kind of brushed it aside. Then on Twitter, we saw later that everyone was commenting that there might have been a meteor.
And yes, it was a meteor. Exactly what does that mean, and might we find any pieces on the ground? Mike Hanke is an amateur meteorite hunter with the American Meteor Society. Glad to have you with us, Mike. We've heard terms like fireball and bolide being used. I've never heard that term, bolide. What's the official name for what happened?
A bolide is a rare type of fireball meteor. Most people have never heard the word before either. And the first time I heard the word, I was like, what is that word? What it really means is that it's a fireball that exploded in what they call a terminal flash. But, you know, some smaller meteors will just kind of burn out or fade out versus like this bolide type of meteor has a crescendo of brightness, and then it just gets bigger and bigger and bigger, and it's this giant ball, and then it goes in this huge flash. And then it's out. And that's a fragmentation event. And it's, you know, not always, but generally it's a sign that something survived to the ground. And when these things happen, there's thousands of meteorites, individual meteorites from this body that break apart in that explosion.
That's fascinating. So that brilliant flash, it was basically saying, all right, I'm what, burning up, reentering the Earth's atmosphere, and then that's it?
It's a release of a massive amount of energy that's sort of compiled as the event took place. The rock just can't handle it anymore, and all the energy just releases in the form of heat and light and its, you know, force on the rock that causes this explosion.
And that 2.0 magnitude earthquake that was reported by the U.S. Geological Society, how does that fit into this?
It's all a phrasing. I think it's a stretch, personally, to say this meteor caused an earthquake, just because the connotation and the meaning that people walk away from that are thinking that, like, plates are actually moving in the earth, or that the meteor struck the earth with such force that it caused this earthquake and the earth to crack. So meteors that penetrate the atmosphere, deep into the atmosphere, will leave a record on the seismic recording station that the U.S. Geological Service operates. And that's one of the signs that we use to determine if meteorites survived and where even those meteorites could be, because you can actually triangulate. If you have three stations that all record it, you can kind of figure out where the event took place.
Gotcha. So it was like the boom from that recorded as a 2.0 on its sensors.
These things can have energy release that's excessive of like the Hiroshima bomb. They're releasing tons of TNT when they explode. And the larger the object is, the more energy that's being released. And so this airburst comes across the atmosphere and then eventually hits the ground around maybe a 50 or so mile radius around where the event happened. And that actually does cause the ground to shake causes houses to shake and windows to rattle, and that's what's being recorded on those sensors.
How large do you think this piece of meteor was?
I would guess that it was over 1 meter and probably in the 1 to 3 meter size range.
So what would that be in like a real object?
Bigger than a grocery cart and smaller than a minivan.
And then could there be fragments to be found?
There could definitely be fragments to be found, but there's really only one way to know if meteorites survived, and that's to go look.
Are we right to be kind of excited about this? Is this a pretty rare occurrence?
It is a rare occurrence. A meteorite recovery in the U.S. happens per year 0 times, so maybe 4 times in a great year. Last year, we had 0 meteorite recoveries in the U.S. There was 1 in Canada. The year before, we had 3. The year before that, we had 1. And the 3 years before that, we had 0. So every time there's a meteorite fall and there's, an opportunity to recover fragments from it is very special, very rare, and doesn't come around that often.
And it gives us that sense that there is something very big out there that we have yet to learn a lot about.
It's always a reminder of our delicate place in the solar system.
Mike Hanke, amateur meteorite hunter with the American Meteor Society. Thank you so much for talking with us, Mike.
Thank you.
This is the second of 4 days of victim impact statements in the sentencing of former MSU gymnastics Dr. Larry Nassar. Woman after woman speaking out to condemn Nassar for sexually abusing them, and some, like Olivia Cowan, aimed strong words at Michigan State University's president and board of trustees.
I'd like to take a moment to comment on MSU's board of trustees, as well as the president of MSU, Louanna Simon. How convenient that you've decided not to attend today. You are a coward, and your decision to watch from the sidelines is perfect representation of your lack of leadership.
Later, Olivia went on to ask,
where were you when we needed you? If you would have only listened to all the women that brought complaints and concerns over all these years, this would have saved so many children and women from being abused and from all the scars this has created.
With us now, Michigan Radio Sports commentator John Eubacon. So we're into day 2 of victim statements. What's been your takeaway so far, John?
You cannot listen to these statements, and you better pull over. You can't drive while listening to these things. You can't do anything else. I'm getting a little choked up right now, and I don't get choked up at all on this show. And our producer, of course, Joe, same thing. It brings back my sensation of being in the Center County courtroom in Pennsylvania listening to the Penn State victims. And it's the same stuff as far as the impact on them, how lives are shattered, and how you see grown women and grown men, in the case of Penn State, become 12-year-old victims before your eyes. When you hear this, yes, it does have an effect, and you scream for justice.
Now, after initially putting out a statement saying MSU President Louanna Simon and Board of Trustees President Brian Breslin didn't want to take attention away from the survivors and therefore they wouldn't attend the sentencing hearing, President Simon did turn up today in the Ingham County courtroom. What do you make of that?
Political expediency. I give her just this much credit for not ducking the second half, I guess. When I heard the announcement yesterday, I was appalled. And not only that they were not going to be there when they should be there, they are partly responsible for this happening. You can't get to 100 victims without some adults looking the other way. Impossible. So I believe they hold some culpability here, and I think their reason for doing so was an utterly insincere, gutless dodge. Cowardless. And that's just what one of the victims says. Mm-hmm. This was cowardice. And she's right on this one. So I thought that was, and don't flatter yourself. Trust me. In that courtroom, the focal point will be on the victims and Dr. Nassar. They'll not be on you. However, the victims have already called them out as being partly responsible, and you need to sit there and hear it.
As we heard from Olivia Cowan yesterday, where were you?
There is not a very good answer for that question, is there? And again, if it's 5 cases, 10 cases, you caught wind of it, I can see that being very difficult. When you've got more than 100 and this person was under investigation for 16 months under investigation by Michigan State University. You called for the investigation and still let him practice. He was still violating, molesting young women during this process. I cannot spin that.
How does MSU and Larry Nassar, in your mind, compare with Penn State and Jerry Sandusky?
Worse. And here's why. And not to make any light of Penn State by any means. The Penn State victims, by the way, were not Penn State victims. They were 10-year-old, 12-year-old kids at a local charity, not sanctioned by Penn State in any way. Jerry Sandusky, through that process, was not a Penn State employee through most of it. So it got to them relatively late. I'm not saying they're innocent by any means. They got the justice they deserve. That president has served 3 months in prison, I believe.
He had 2 months in jail and 2 months of house arrest. And Graham Spanier, this former Penn State president, was once a leading figure in higher ed in this country, and he got jail time.
Exactly right. And don't forget, President Simon at Michigan State had a lot to say about Penn State at the time. Highly judgmental. Well, here we are. The distinction here is that in this case, many of these young women were Michigan State students, Michigan State athletes. Dr. Larry Nassar was a Michigan State employee, supervised by Michigan State employees. So that is a fundamental distinction with Penn State.
Now, kind of you think about, there are these calls for President Simon to resign. The Board of Trustees gave her a vote of confidence and a raise. But you got to wonder from their perspective, is this the right time to fire her? I mean, who would want to jump in now in the middle of this mess?
You're right about that. This is a mess. However, my first reaction is that's your problem. All right. Actions of consequences. You know what you do to avoid this? You take action 2, 3, 4 years ago when you could have. So guess what? It is messy. Second of all, I would say this, that what they did at Penn State, what they do at other universities when things get this messy, is you get rid of the president and you bring in an interim, possibly a provost or a former president. This is not at all difficult. And if Michigan State's leadership's lives are made a little more difficult, I'm not going to feel too bad having listened just before I got in the air with you to Olivia's statement, which is still making my skin crawl.
Lessons for schools everywhere?
Your character is what you do when you think no one's watching. And if you have an employee who does not understand that, you better have a supervisor who does. And in this case, both failed.
Michigan Radio Sports Commentator, John Eubacon. Thanks, John.
Thank you.
We asked an MSU spokesman why President Simon changed her mind and chose to attend this afternoon's court proceedings. He said she was watching the women's testimonials yesterday remotely and thought it was important to be there in person. This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. He's been widely praised for his paintings about natural history and ecological history. Now, New York artist Alexis Rockman has turned to Michigan's treasure, the Great Lakes. His new show, Alexis Rockman, The Great Lakes Cycle, opens at the Grand Rapids Art Museum January 27th. Rockman started working on this project 5 years ago, starting off with a research tour of the Great Lakes. The heart of the exhibition is a suite of five large, mural-sized paintings. They illustrate themes that Rockman developed as he traveled around the lakes, discovering their beauty and the dangers that threaten them. Alexis Rockman is here with us now. Welcome.
So happy to be here. Thank you for having me.
What brought you to the Great Lakes, to this project?
It was a combination of things. First of all, I got an invitation from Dana Friis Hansen, who's the director and CEO and was the curator of the project at the Grand Rapids Art Museum. And he is someone that I've been working with off and on since the 1980s, so I've known him a long time professionally. And he said, Alexis, do you have a dream project? And I looked at the map and I thought, well, something about the Great Lakes would be fascinating because it has 20% of the world's fresh water. And as you may know, the future of fresh water is really the future of mankind.
And you began, I'm fascinated with this tour you did. Tell us kind of about that tour, where you went, the lakes you saw, and who you talked to.
Well, first of all, I read a number of books before I got on a plane to come out to Grand Rapids, where I started the tour. So one of the books that I read was by Jeff Alexander called Pandora's Locks, and it's sort of a cautionary tale of the deep history and recent history of many of the threats and stresses that have befallen the Great Lakes. obviously from human activity, both deliberate and unintended. So there's a dark side to the history of the Great Lakes. And then what I asked the Grand Rapids Art Museum to do was to develop an itinerary for me where I would rent a car in Grand Rapids and drive around Lake Michigan over about a 2.5-week period. So I told them that I'm willing to work, let's just say, work for food. And I said I'm willing to have 3 to 4 meetings a day as long as I don't have to drive for more than 8 hours a day. And I got an itinerary that sort of took me to places like the Lighthouse Museum, Northern Michigan University, relatively obscure natural history museums, mineralogy, mining, any number of things that might be interesting that would sort of open my eyes empirically and immersively to some of the history of the Great Lakes. And two of the people that I had a great time talking to at Northern Michigan University was an ichthyologist named Dr. Jill Leonard, who really helped me develop the project and the 5 paintings and has been a great help for the last couple of years, and Max Strand, who's also an ecologist at Northern Michigan University. And these two people were just incredibly important to not only the intellectual credibility of the projects, but also just the moral support. Because as you may know, when you're working on something for years and years and years, you sort of get buried under it sometimes. So
I can imagine.
People to talk to.
And I bet there is that kind of feeling of being cut off.
Yes, and my wife is a big help also because she's a writer and not particularly interested in natural history, so I'd run ideas by her and show her images and see if it made any sense to her, if it was interesting to her. And I felt that if it was interesting to her, her name's Dorothy Spears, that would be a big help because so much of what I'm interested in doing is being a populist and appealing to people that aren't necessarily fascinated by the things I'm fascinated by.
Well, and you do that so well through these paintings that I've only seen on pages on the internet, and it's going to be worth driving to the Grand Rapids Art Museum to see these. And I love the way you describe these natural history psychedelia. What does that term mean to you?
Well, I mean, isn't nature psychedelic or being alive psychedelic? Just the ability to wake up every morning. So it's not that big of a stretch, but many of the things that I'm fascinated by are the collision between stories that we might be familiar with, like the zebra mussels and the lamprey, some of the darker things that have been celebrated. But then there's some other things that are microscopic, like botulism problems, microplastics, all these things. So when you're dealing with a cosmic scale and the microscopic, that is psychedelic, isn't it?
It is. It is. And there is this incredibly cool science fiction-y feel to the way you present these very, very real-life dangers. And I can see where people can get pulled in and learn. And I find it fascinating that there will be keys available, right?
Yeah,
so
absolutely.
People will get what you're talking about. I'm wondering how you became the one who bridges the worlds between art and science. I mean, were you drawn to nature and science as a kid growing up
in
New York?
Yeah, it's really like a linear trajectory where if you saw pictures of drawings I was making when I was 8, it wouldn't look that different.
Okay.
You know, squid under the water, coral reefs, a dinosaur, stuff like that. Never in the same picture.
Well, we in Michigan, we've grown up surrounded by the Great Lakes, so getting your fresh eye is what I think people are going to really respond to. Do you see this call, this show, Alexis, as a call to action?
Well, I mean, I don't know what art can do at this point. I mean, when you're dealing with an administration that appeals to our lowest common bases of, you know, wanting to be in denial about our own mortality and just basic facts of not only science, but observation, then there's a profound call to action. I don't know if art can help, but I know certainly that journalism is one of the last things that can save us, and that's been proven time and again, especially in America, free press. So I consider part of what I do an extension of that, and one of the great things that I can do as an artist is that I don't have to answer to anyone in terms of my content. I don't have a corporate overlord or a Death Star to answer to. So I'm pretty much free to say what I want. And as long as I'm responsible to history and science and my ideas about that, I consider myself relatively informed enough to give myself permission to tell these stories.
And as we mentioned, your show opens at the Grand Rapids Art Museum January 27th, and it'll run till April 29th. And then it's kind of going on a Great Lakes tour, going to Chicago and Cleveland and Minneapolis. And I know
Flint.
It'll be in Flint. So we've got these five big mural paintings. Milwaukee. It really is a Great Lakes tour.
Just like the Grateful Dead.
There you go. And what do you hope people who see these huge mural paintings and also the field drawings and the smaller paintings you've done, what do you hope they take away from the Great Lakes cycle?
Well, I don't know. I mean, hopefully they forget all their partisan meddling and think about the bigger responsibility that we have as stewards of this planet, and that, you know, there's a fascinating and beautiful resource there that needs our care and tenderness. And, you know, petty party policy lines are irrelevant to this stuff, and that this stuff is forever. And, you know, people come and go, but this is our legacy.
Artist Alexis Rockman, his exhibition, The Great Lakes Cycle, will be opening January 27th at GRAM, the Grand Rapids Art Museum. Alexis, thank you so much for spending time with us.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks for asking.
Support for arts and culture coverage comes in part from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs. It is Wednesday, and that means it's time to talk our state's history.
I've sent the following wire to President Truman. My heartiest congratulations to you on your election.
I'm aware of my blackness, but I don't go around and look and see whether I'm different than someone else.
Fail a lot quickly, and then eventually you'll succeed.
I worry that the person who thought up Muzak may be thinking up something else.
Snow. It's part of what makes Michigan Michigan. In fact, some of a certain age might remember Michigan's license plates used to include the phrase water, winter, wonderland. Some hate the snow, others love it. But there's no arguing. Snow has been the mother of invention for many a Michigander. Case in point, snurfing. What's that, you say? Well, let's find out as we welcome from the Michigan History Center, Rachel Clark, and Michigan High School Athletic Association historian and film documentarian, Ron Pesch. Good to have you with us.
Hello.
Thanks for having us.
All right. So let's get everybody on the same page. Snurfing, nothing to do with little blue cartoon characters, right, Rachel?
Nope, nothing to do with Smurfs.
All right. So in a nutshell, Rachel, what is snurfing?
So snurfing is sort of the precursor to what we now know as snowboarding. It came out as essentially two skis that were together. It measured 4 feet long by about 7 inches wide. The original ones were yellow and black, and it had a rope on the end of it, and you would stand on it, hopefully, and go down the hill on it, the snow hill. It was invented by a guy named Sherman Poppin from Muskegon.
All right, Ron, take us back to Christmas Day 1965 in Muskegon. What went down then?
Well, the Poppin family, Sherm, his wife Nancy, and their two daughters, 9-year-old Wendy and 4-year-old Lori, had opened all the gifts, and the girls were pretty excited. Nancy was just a few days away from giving birth to the family's third daughter, Julie, and she asked or maybe demanded that Sherm take the girls outside to work off some of that energy and give her the chance to take a nap. Christmas Eve, there was a blanket of new snow in Muskegon, about a foot's worth, and Sherm took the girls out, tried to grab a sled, but it wasn't plowing through the light, fluffy snow, so he grabbed a couple kids' skis, bolted them together, and brought them out to the girls as a new plaything to try to go through the light, fluffy snow. It didn't work out so well with the sled, but great with this little board that he created. And the girls were seated on it initially, but stood up on the thing, and it was wonderful. They had a great time. Sherm himself wanted to ride this board, and over the next few weeks started tinkering, trying to come up with a better version of it to allow everybody to play on it. His wife, Nancy, gave it a name called snurfing, a combination of snow and surfing. And that really started this move to create a new toy.
A true aha moment. Now, Rachel, Sherm Poppin could see the potential in snurfing. What steps happened next?
So Brunswick Corporation is in Muskegon, and he invited some people that he knew from Brunswick to come over and give it a try. And so they went snurfboarding and loved it. And so some conversations started happening, and most people think of or understand Brunswick to be bowling alleys. But apparently there was a bit of a lull in the bowling industry at this time, and so they were looking sort of for other things. So in spring, he patented the snurfboard, and then they made it to the market for the following Christmas.
Well, that's pretty fast turnaround, I must say. Opportunity and an idea meet in a happy marriage. Ron, snurfing, did it begin to grow pretty quickly, and did competitive snurfing become a thing?
Well, it became a hit in the market. A number of kids got a snurfer under the Christmas tree over those next couple of years. Locally, of course, it was huge, and local fraternity at Muskegon Community College decided that they were going to host the world's first World Snurfing Classic in 1968. A guy named Ted Slater, who was a member of the fraternity and the first male champion in the sport called snurfing, he described it as a world event because Muskegon was the first place to host a snurfing competition. More or less over the next several years, it was an annual event, you know, kind of dependent on how much snow you had, but it was hosted continuously by the community college kids. And by 1978, it had turned into an event that had sponsorship, financial sponsorship, and they gave away cash prizes. In 1979, a young man who had just started a company in 77 named Jake Burton Carpenter came to Muskegon, Michigan to compete in that event. The challenge was that the folks that manufactured the board at the time, now GEM Corporation, folks were a little concerned that a guy riding something other than a snurfer might win the competition. So they split it into two events, one for those riding snurfers and one for those riding something other than a branded snurfer could compete. Jake Burton, who had created this board, won that second event and took home $250. But Muskegon really became the epicenter for this new industry that was emerging, where people took the poppin' concept and altered it.
Even though he had a patent on it, huh? They were able to tweak it enough to make it not a violation of patent laws?
Well, that was the challenge that came up. Of course, Sherm had trademarked the name snurfing, and because of that, that really evolved into an issue for these guys that were creating new boards. They couldn't call it a snurfer. So to escape that, what they did was really change the name of the sport. And it evolved from snurfing into snow surfing into what we know today as snowboarding.
It's almost like Beta came first and then VHS tapes and then VHS vanquished Beta. So it almost sounds like the upstart snowboarders vanquished snurfing.
That's correct. Sherm has often said that one of his biggest regrets is that he was so stubborn protecting that trademark that they changed the name on the sport.
Huh. Rachel, I hear you've got a personal connection to snurfing. Tell us about that.
Yes, my family had two of them when I was a kid. So I'm the youngest of seven. So by the time I came around, we only had one left. But I did check with my brother, my oldest brother, Steve, and he remembers getting the snurfboard in the winter of 68 or 69. And we would go snurfing down the hill in our backyard. So the funniest thing, I always called it the banana, because to me, when I was little, it looked like a banana. And the funny thing, though, was the grips on the snurfboards that we have, or the snurfers that we had, were essentially very similar to heavy gauge staples. And that's sort of what your boot gripped to. So sitting on it was not the most comfortable thing in the world. But that board lasted us through the snowstorm of 78. I rode on it in the 85 ice storm, for those people who remember the 1985 ice storm.
Yes.
And so, yep. So I have to say thank you to my brothers, Steve, Paul, and John Lancor, for helping me sort of establish a timeline on our snurfboards.
Any chance that we might see you, Rachel, on an Antique Roadshow in about 20 years trying to get a price for an original snurfer?
I would love to. They were really fun. They were a lot of fun. And they had a rope on the end of it, which was very handy. So if you weren't comfortable just standing there, you could hold on to it.
Ron, tell us, how did things ultimately turn out for Sherm Poppin?
Well, Sherm started a local business here in Muskegon, Lake Welding, that did very, very well. He always says that he really didn't make a lot of money on his creation, but he is recognized as the grandfather of the sport.
So the next time you see snowboarders hitting the slope or watch them winning Olympic medals in just a few weeks in South Korea, we Michiganders can certainly give a hat tip to the ingenious Sherm Poppin. Michigan History Center's Rachel Clark and Michigan High School Athletic Association historian and film documentarian Ron Pesch. Thanks to both of you for sharing the evolution of snurfing to snowboarding. It was a great trip back in time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
There are efforts underway to modernize Michigan's 911 system, and we plan to discuss details next week on Stateside. But first, we want to hear from you. What questions do you have about 911 in Michigan? We also want to hear your stories. Have you called 911 recently? Did everything go smoothly, or were there hiccups? Tell us about your experience. You can leave us a voicemail by calling 734-764-7840. That's 734-764-7840. Or just go to the Stateside page at michiganradio.org and share your story there. Back after a short break. Stay with us. This is Stateside. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. The sandhill crane is Michigan's largest bird and oldest living bird species. 15 states allow hunting sandhill cranes. Hunters need both a state and a federal license. Michigan is not among those states, not yet. But a proposal to hunt sandhill cranes in our state is gaining traction. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service says if Michigan asks, it will grant permission to hunt the bird. Detroit Free Press reporter Keith Matheny is here with us now. Keith, why are the feds saying if Michigan asks, we'll say yes?
Well, basically, Michigan is along what's known as the eastern population of sandhill cranes. That's been a population that's been limited in size for a number of years. It's been a recovering species after, for example, in Michigan, it was almost hunted into extinction, if you will, in the early 20th century, but it's been making a rebound since then. And that's sort of been the story along this eastern population flyway. Now, because it's a migratory bird, it falls under the Migratory Bird Treaty Act, and that means the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service has the ultimate say on whether it's hunted. Because the population has rebounded to a point that they believe it can sustain hunting, any state along this flyway that asks will be allowed to hunt it.
And there's this move growing in Michigan. Who's in favor? Who's pushing to get sandhill cranes a hunting season in Michigan?
Well, the Michigan United Conservation Clubs last summer, I believe, really kind of pushed this forward in terms of ratifying a support for it. By the fall, the State House of Representatives passed a resolution supporting hunting in Michigan, but that ultimately would fall to the State Natural Resources Commission. They have not taken up the matter yet, but there's some indication that there is support for going for a hunt at the DNR level.
I noted a piece that you wrote this month for the Free Press that hunters are anxious to try the ribeye of the sky.
It's known as the ribeye of the sky. I've personally never tried it, but I'm told that the meat is quite tasty.
Okay, and farmers are saying cranes uproot the young shoots of corn in the spring and eat the kernels. Does anything support that claim?
Well, indeed, I hear a lot of anecdotal stories about the damage they can do to corn in the spring and to winter wheat later in the year. However, there is a federal program where hunters who are experiencing a nuisance from these birds can get a permit now to shoot them. You actually can't eat them after you shoot them when you kill them with this permit. But that permit use in Michigan has been pretty limited. It's under 80 permits as of last count. Have been used in a year.
Okay. You actually had another story, Keith, that reported on some actions of questions maybe raised, we should say, about the actions of the DNR and also State Representative James Lauer in this push for the Sandhill crane hunt and a certain illustration that he used in his presentation.
Correct. So when the State House of Representatives was considering this resolution to support a hunt, James Lauer, he's a Republican from Cedar Lake, was one of the leading proponents of that. I believe he was the author of the resolution. During his presentation at a House Natural Resources Committee hearing last October, he had a PowerPoint, and in the PowerPoint he showed a slide of farmer's tractor surrounded with hundreds and hundreds of what appear to be sandhill cranes. And he said, this slide shows a little bit of the damage you can do. You know, there's thousands of these birds in the field, and the farmer's trying to grow some crops there, and the birds are creating an issue. Well, turns out that photo came from a USDA report, and it was a photo from Israel, not Michigan. The birds were another type of crane, not sandhill cranes, and that tractor in the photo was there to feed them, which is why they were crowding around, the idea being, if we feed them in this location, maybe they'll leave our crops alone. So the Michigan Songbird Protection Coalition, which is a nonprofit organization that's one of the leading opponents of establishing sandhill crane hunting, kind of cried foul on that. They also received some emails on sandhill crane hunt that had circulated among DNR officials that they obtained through the Freedom of Information Act. And though the DNR's outward position is that they have no position on a hunt, that they're just sort of fact-gathering, some of the top people in the Wildlife Division in the emails, in private conversations with staff, are pretty openly advocating for a hunt.
So where do things stand now, Keith? What do we watch for?
I think we watch for when this comes up on a Natural Resources Commission agenda. They're saying right now that they want to find more information on what sorts of problems farmers are having, what the alternatives to a hunt to try to control any agricultural problems might be. So I guess we just wait and see when they take it up. And again, if it's approved at the state level, it will then have to go through this federal process. But my reporting's indicated that federal process would be more or less a rubber stamp allowing a hunt.
Detroit Free Press reporter Keith Matheny. As always, Keith, thank you so much.
Thank you.
The name America was drawn from the first name of the Italian explorer Amerigo Vespucci, who died in 1512. But the first inhabitants of what we now call North America called it Turtle Island. A new video game called Thunderbird Strike lets players protect Turtle Island from the oil industry. The game's creator is Elizabeth LaPonce. She's an assistant professor of media and information, as well as writing rhetoric and American cultures at Michigan State University. And you could recall, we spoke with her in late 2016 about her app, Honoring Water, which teaches users Anishinaabe songs about water. Anishinaabe is the name used by Native tribes, including the Odawa, Ojibwe, Potawatomi, and Algonquin peoples. Now, in this new video game, Elizabeth again draws upon her Native American heritage. Elizabeth LaPonce, welcome back.
Thank you, Miigwech, for having me.
What is the premise, Elizabeth, behind Thunderbird Strike?
In Thunderbird Strike, you play as a thunderbird, and you are striking lightning down at, optionally, mining company buildings and the big giant mining trucks, as well as at the bones of caribou, wolves, and buffalo to bring them back to life, and of people to activate them.
What's the importance of the Thunderbird, the significance of the Thunderbird to Native American people?
Well, there are many different stories. The stories that are reflected in Thunderbird Strike come from storytellers like Isaac Murdoch, with interpretations by artists like Christy Belcourt, and then also the way that I was raised and the teachings I received from my mother and from my aunties, that thunderbirds really are a form of storms, that they do have genuine forms as well, and stories that they walk among us again. And this is seen very clearly in the work of Isaac Murdoch and Thunderbird Woman, who appears in the game during one of the cutscenes. So the idea is that thunderbirds are here to protect us and the lands and the waters. And in the game, you can choose what you strike your lightning at, and you gain either restoration points or destruction points. for a total high score.
Okay. And where is the Thunderbird flying from? From where to where?
So the Thunderbird is flying from the tar sands in Alberta all the way to the Mackinac Bridge where Line 5 is underneath in the waters. So that's the trajectory. And the reason why the game is that pathway, you actually fly from right to left rather than from left to right, which is the usual convention in games. You know, you see that a lot in game design. Instead, you're actually looking at the world through an Anishinaabe lens. And so we look from, at least I'm from Bawating, so we look from the point of the Great Lakes looking south towards Michigan, right? And so from that perspective, then the tar sands journey all the way to the Great Lakes would be right to left flight. So that's what you're doing in the game.
What age range do you feel that you've designed this game for?
It's definitely for ages 10 and over. I mean, this is something where parents can make their own choice about who is playing it, but it falls under the 10 and older age range as far as like the apps are considered, right? You know, on Apple Store and on Google Play.
You mentioned Line 5, Enbridge's Line 5, and these, of course, are the dual pipelines running under the Straits of Mackinac. We've talked lots about Line 5 here on Stateside. How is Line 5 portrayed in the game?
It's portrayed as a pipeline snake boss in the final battle scene. You can strike lightning at it, but it will eventually deconstruct on its own as well, which is portraying the messages from our stories that inevitably a spill is very highly likely to happen underneath the water. It's not so much a matter of if the damage is going to be done, but more so, you know, what can be done now to prevent more damage from happening, and what can we do to restore the lands and the waters that have been affected, which is why, you know, you can also bring animals back to life in the game.
And what does that do?
So that gives you restoration points, and they come back to life and they fill the scene then. Caribou are in there because they're projected to become extinct because of the activity that's happening in the tar sands. Buffalo are there because they're also in the tar sands and very integral to the well-being of Indigenous communities just throughout the generations. And wolves are there because there have been a lot of issues at oil camps where wolves are left with very little food sources around the camps. And so they come towards camps for food sources, and effectively workers are told that they're supposed to shoot the wolves. And so, you know, this kind of activity is all happening around it. And so the game is meant to reflect, you know, what would happen if instead we're focusing on the well-being of and the lives of these animals.
You received a grant from the state of Minnesota through the Arrowhead Regional Arts Council. One state senator in Minnesota described your game, I'm quoting here, as an eco-terrorist version of Angry Birds. And earlier this month, there was an editorial in the Lansing State Journal by the director of Consumer Energy Alliance Midwest. And he questioned the fact that a faculty member of Michigan's largest university has developed a game that essentially advocates for the destruction of energy pipelines. How do you respond to these criticisms?
To clarify, there was grant funding from Minnesota, which did go towards the game. That's well reflected. And I was audited as a part of this process, which was a fun experience. But because I am a very honest and forthright person and I do what I say I'm going to do and follow through, everything checked out, because ultimately that attempt on the part of that Minnesota senator was to silence me. And eventually was to go after the tax-funded portion of that grant, which, you know, ultimately I did exactly what I said I was going to do, and the Arts Council stood behind me, as did many other people in support of the game. And then, you know, again, I think what's interesting about this is that there is a community of oil lobbyists who continuously come back to trying to connect the game to Michigan State University because of my affiliation. The game had started a couple of years before I even came here and was a part of my work as I transitioned into Michigan State University. And so I went through the whole process of clarifying that all of the art assets and code and everything from the game is not on MSU-owned equipment. You know, no resources were used from MSU towards the game. It does have a thank you for MSU because I am faculty here, you know, and so that's really what happened, was there was a thank you to Michigan State University, and then these really vast and far-reaching attempts to portray MSU as supporting something that it shouldn't have in lieu of trying to shut down the game. I mean, their ultimate goal is to eradicate My Voice, is to have the game removed from stores, removed from any kind of distribution services. Like, they want me silenced. And thankfully, the game is what it is. It's a 2D side scroller. A lot of people have described it as cute or adorable. And anyone who has actually played the game, because notably everyone who has chosen to speak up and publish words against me about this particular game have not actually played the game.
Okay.
And so that's an important, you know, factor to note there. You know, so I think that the game stays up. Freedom of speech is vital. I am doing my best to pass on stories from my communities and reflect our concerns through our worldview. And I hope that people will continue to play the game and talk about the game and understand what it's all about.
Why use simulations of violence in the game? I mean, if it's not about destroying the pipelines, what is it about?
Well, I mean, when you strike the lightning at the pipelines, they disappear. And so in our stories, we talk about how we need alternate systems. You know, we cannot continue, like physically, we cannot continue to remove oil from the earth because it is causing shifts in the land, which are destructive. Oil spills also cause a great deal of harm. And so really, I don't feel that the game does reflect or advocate violence because, you know, I mean, it's an act of disappearing, right? The idea is that it should discontinue itself. That's the message of the game. And the message being that, you know, if this structure does not disappear, it will eventually deconstruct on its own if it's not maintained. And that's been a huge part of the issue, especially with Enbridge, is that, you know, there were physical issues with the pipelines that were not being addressed and have not been addressed. And so the hope there is to draw some attention to that and ensure that we can more immediately get structures in place to protect the waters in the Great Lakes across Minnesota and, of course, all through Saskatchewan and Alberta as well, just all along the way of Turtle Island.
So if we don't get our energy needs met through these pipelines transporting oil or natural gas, what do you view as an acceptable alternative approach to these pipelines? I mean, the solution, if you will.
Right. Interestingly, Batchewana First Nation has chosen to diversify their energy sources. So they have both wind and solar power. My grandfather, Lou Leponsky, speaks about this as well, how we really need to not focus on one energy source and put everything into one industry, but we need to diversify our industry resources and to look to alternate pathways. And so certainly those are viable pathways with balance, everything in balance.
What do you hope people will learn about the Anishinaabe people and culture through this game, through Thunderbird Strikes?
I hope that they will look at the stories and look at the art and really reflect on what the meaning is for them.
And it's available for people to be able to play. It's a simple game, isn't it, compared to many of the games out there. Was that a deliberate choice?
Absolutely. It can be played within maybe 10 to 15 minutes. It's really intended to be a game which can be replayed, actually, because it's a high score game. So you can play it over and over again. And we actually have soon there will be winners announced for the high score contest, which is being run by a podcast network called A Tribe Called Geek. Whoever wins it, it will receive custom Thunderbird art prints that I'll be working on for them, and they get to choose the colors and all of that. So that'll be a part of this process. But yeah, it's available on Android phones and on tablets, on iPhone, iPad, and then also for PC. And it's all free. The intention is for it to be a free game, which can be played by anyone who is interested.
Elizabeth Leponsky, who is an assistant professor of media and information and writing rhetoric and American cultures at Michigan State University, and the creator and the designer and the writer of the new video game Thunderbird Strike. Thanks so much for speaking with us, Elizabeth.
Thank you, Miigwech.
Today's Stateside was directed by Allie Billings and engineered by Peg Watson. Stateside's executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors are Mike Blank, Danny Hensel, Sarah Leeson, Mercedes Mejia, and Lindsay Scullin. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so very much for listening.